This is the one with Not So Silly String.
Can be Clark Kent.
The return of not one, but two foes.
And the introduction of the soon-to-be Brigadier.
It's called the Web of Fear.
Here we go.
We're embarking on a voyage all through time and all through space.
Counting Daleks, Dalenhood, and the Cybertronic race.
Tantarans look like taters, and Silurians all have wonky scales.
And the Doctor has a TARDIS, we're reviewing all his tales.
Who back when?
Reviewing all of who there is.
Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Episode by episode, we're trudging down this temporal road. Come join us on this odyssey. What other choice could there be than who back when?
Who back when?
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast.
Or Doc Past.
This week we'll be discussing C-041, The Web of Fear.
Damn right we will. Who are you?
I am Nicol Lely, and what's that lovely voice I hear in my ears, ladies and gentlemen?
I'm Ponkin. Hello.
We're still very much enjoying the new mics.
Yeah, pretty good. There are effects in this thing, by the way. We can have like an echo. Ladies and gentlemen, write in if you want the next classic episodes to sound like we're in a cave.
Or a flange. I'm not really sure what a flange is, but I have a pedal at home that does a flange.
Oh, yeah. Hot.
Let's do a B-scale.
Let's do a B-scale. The Second Doctor, Jamie and Victoria finally stabilized the TARDIS, but now they're stuck in some sort of fungus and suspended in time and space. They escape, but soon find that a vast intellect, or let's call it great intelligence, has pulled them to the London Underground in 1975, when and where it has used its robot Yeti to take over the city.
Soldiers are battling the Yeti invasion when their leader is killed by the alien robot menace. Who better to step into his shoes and lead the troops, but... Were you going to say the Doctor? You'd be wrong. Enter stage Lethbridge Stewart in his first appearance on Doctor Who.
Obviously the Doc helps as well.
B-scale over. You are welcome.
Well, great. Yeah, no, but let's bring even more oomph to this. Okie dokie, this is a 6-episode arc. The whole thing, not the whole thing, I was about to say the whole thing is intact, but it actually isn't. 5 out of 6 episodes are perfectly intact. And, well, I was a little bit surprised. We watched the standard BBC DVD of this.
The remastered version.
Yeah, exactly. And I was a little bit surprised because I was hoping that the 3rd episode, which is the missing one, the sole missing episode, that it would be one of those animated ones.
No, it was just stills. Just stills.
Yeah.
Just production stills, which was not intact. Entirely dynamic.
No, not really. It looked very much like a Loose Cannon Productions recon. It wasn't, I suppose. I mean, it seems officially BBC, but yeah. So that's it. 6 episodes, 3, one of them is a recon.
Yeah.
But buy the DVD! You're welcome, BBC.
Okay, so we start where we left off, actually. It's not... We haven't resolved the end of the enemy of the world, it would seem.
Yeah, exactly. We ended on a cliffhanger.
Exactly. The TARDIS is very much in peril. Everyone's still hanging on for dear life.
Yeah.
As the Salamander had plunged to his death. And we get a lot of thigh.
We did.
I missed the thigh.
I was actually going to almost apologize for this because in the screenshots of Enemy of the World that I added to whobackwhen.com, I think I accidentally added a screenshot from the introduction to this episode. The one where it looks like they're just competing who can be Big Spoon. Yeah, we get to see a lot of Victoria's thigh.
And this serial's all the better for it.
I think so.
Yeah.
We also get an explanation of what happened to Salamander, because when we were doing, when we finished reviewing Enemy of the World, we were saying, well, what happened to him? Where is he now? Is he in space? Is he in the vortex? Where is he? And the Doctor actually says he is now floating around in time and space.
So both. I mean, I guess, aren't we all?
Yes, I suppose so. Does this mean that, like, bits of Salamander are going to appear throughout history?
Maybe everyone that thinks that they see the Doctor is actually seeing the Salamander.
Oh, wow. Yeah, lots of, like, stray occurrences or, you know, appearances of the Doctor.
Yeah, and all those people that think he's a, you know, a diktat and a horrible people, you know, as it comes up.
They're actually thinking of, yes, that's exactly, can we write that?
I think we should write that. The Salamander's Adventures. Done. Patent pending. Whatever the fucking term is.
Yeah, cool. Is this now in the public domain?
Probably.
78? No, it's not.
Yeah, someone else.
Give it a little bit of time.
Absolutely.
BBC, we're coming for you. okay, so... They stabilize the TARDIS. It's now no longer, like, they close the door, basically.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it seems as though they've landed.
Oh, and it stopped. It stopped, yeah.
And according to, like, all of their gadgets, it seems as though they've landed. But in fact, the Doctor says they're now suspended in time and space.
Mm.
And we get to see an exterior shot of the TARDIS.
Which is just space.
Yeah, but the TARDIS is, like, covered in what looks like cobweb.
Yeah, and this, we'll come back to this often, yeah. Right? One of my biggest cons of this entire serial...
We might have the exact same thing now.
...is how often they refer to seemingly very identifiable, or at least, you know, phenomena, webs, fungus, you know, bubbly things, as something else entirely. So they look at it, it's like some sort of fungus. Like, it's clearly webbing.
It looks like webbing. But that wasn't going to be my beef with this.
Right.
But, okay, let's put a pin in this now and return to it later on when I have my massive beef with this cobweb.
Call it the web of fungus.
Well, I was going to ask you, did you think that this was the web of fear? Because I was thinking, actually, it's the tube map. The tube map is the web of fear.
Yeah.
Because there is no web, it's as you say, they go like, oh, this is fungus.
Well, I guess what really bothered me is that when I sat down for this, not knowing any, like, I had not read up on it, didn't know the great intelligence, you know, didn't know there were yetis, etc.
Yeah.
I was expecting something, an arachnid in nature.
Okay. Same here, to be honest.
Absolutely.
That makes perfect sense.
And all of that. So I saw some webbing. I thought, okay, we're on.
We've had the web planet already.
Yeah, exactly. And all that sort of stuff. So it's just nomenclature. It really bothered me.
But I think maybe they're being unusually clever in this one. They're not referring, it's not like the fungus of fear, which would have been a nice alliteration. It's like, it's the web of fear. And we get all these gratuitous shots of the tube map.
I will buy that, but... To a point.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It may be completely wrong.
If that wasn't the case, why is so much of your fungus look like webbing?
Okay, that is also a good point. Yeah.
Let's move on.
All right, fine. They then dematerialize and rematerialize in the London Underground.
And so my first big note here is that for someone that spends quite a lot of time in post-war London,
yeah,
just a phenomenal amount of time, even up to this point.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, I'll forgive Jamie for not knowing, and Victoria less so, because I think the tube was knocking about at this point.
Okay.
Wandering around. And again, before I knew that this took place in the underground, the arches, the tiling, I thought, well, that's the underground.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Covent Garden, like in massive letters. Was it Covent Garden?
I think that's the first place that they land, right next to Covent Garden. They walk through the tunnel and they arrive in Covent Garden.
That's true. And so I was like, how have you not recognised this place instantly?
By the way, a bit of trivia. The set, this was just a set.
Mm.
And the set was so convincing that after this aired on TV, Transport for London got in touch with the BBC and said that they had filmed on their property without a permit.
And I would... that makes absolute sense to me, because I was convinced that they'd got... Because there are, ladies and gentlemen, if those of you not familiar with the London Underground, there are ghost stations are often used for filming and that sort of thing. Stations that are disused and otherwise. And again,
they're ghost stations. That's a station just for ghosts, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was very good. I thought the set design was very good, but the fact that the Doctor wouldn't easily recognize this, not so great.
Yeah. Actually, I think we've jumped a little bit, but it doesn't really matter. The next thing that they do is they materialize in the London Underground. But at this point, we've also got a glimpse of a character whom we met in The Abominable Snowman.
Oh, yes.
Professor Travers.
Yeah, although he's morphed into Professor, in my note is Professor Mumbletron.
Mumbletron.
Yeah. I don't know what the fuck he's saying half the time. I am jowling.
He's in the home, or like the viewing the private collection.
It's a museum, I think. Because at some point he does say my museum and collection. And one of my notes
is definitely a private collection.
Yeah, I think so.
Belonging to, I don't know, insert Jewish stereotype. What's his name?
Silverstein.
I'm a Jew, so I'm okay to say
something Stein. Something Stein.
Silverstein? Goldstein.
Goldstein.
Goldberg? Let's just call him Goldberg.
I think it's Silverstein. But anyway, something. I also did...
it is Silverstein. Julia Silverstein.
There you go. When I thought it was a museum, I put, why light your museum like Nosferatu's broom cupboard?
Yeah, exactly. It's just candlelit.
Why is it so poorly lit? Surely you want to see this collection.
Yeah, well, I mean, ambience, dude. Ambience. All right, so... He's in this collection, this dude, Silverstein, Goldberg. He has, among other things, got one of the Yeti that Professor Travers brought back from Tibet. So Professor Travers, you know what? Sort it. Go to whobackwhen.com and listen to our Abominable Snowman episode, because this is a direct sequel to that. In Abominable Snowman, the Doctor fights Yetis that are not Yetis. They are, in that review, referred to as Nyetis, by the way, because they're just robots that are meant to look like Yetis. This is very important. I'm bringing this up because I want to put a pin in that as well. And it turns out the Nyetis were constructed by the Great Intelligence, whom we all know from New Who. So here he is now, and for some reason he's parted with it. Why does Silverstein own the Yeti?
I don't know. I mean, as a academic and scientist and all those sort of things, he thought he'd make a quick buck. I'm not really sure.
So Professor Travis just sold the Yeti.
Well, because yes, he did say we had an agreement and he sold it. And
oh, they actually say it. Okay.
Oh, I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure there was an agreement, and that's why Silverstein accuses Professor Mumbletron of being a thief. And actually,
oh wait, why? What? Wait, he doesn't. He's not trying. Why? Because he's trying to like take it back.
Take it back, exactly.
Oh,
yes, yeah. Not that he has done so far, but that he bids to. Yes.
Yeah.
But there is a great exchange, the best so far in Who. Great insult exchange.
Oh, really?
Of you old goat, you.
Oh yes. Oh, it's fantastic.
You stubborn so and so Jewish people like that. That's basically the.
That's definitely it.
Yeah.
And Silverstein's like, I don't give a shit. I own this. I'm not selling it. I'm not going to part with it. The reason Professor Travers, do we find out the reason Professor Travers wants the Yeti back?
We do. We should say that he's flown in his scientist daughter.
Yes.
Anne.
Anne Travers.
Sassy Anne.
Oh.
Sassy Anne, scientist Anne.
Sassy Anne.
Sassy Anne.
Sassy Anne. Sassy Anne. So, yes. And actually, my only note for this entire scene, by the way, is Dad of the Year award goes to Professor Travers. Because could he be any more disparaging towards his daughter?
I don't think so.
And do you want to know something else that's really disparaging towards her?
Go on.
They're both scientists, right?
Mm.
He is constantly, throughout the entire thing, he's referred to as Professor Travers, and she's referred to as Miss.
Yeah. Oh, maybe.
And she says she's a lifelong career scientist.
She may have not got a chair yet.
Well, she doesn't. Well, surely she has a doctorate.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe she's just a lecturer.
What do you think? Like, she has an MSc or something and has spent her entire life as an MSc working on, like, hardcore science shit.
I haven't done. I mean, with the state of science today and how little women are represented, I can't imagine the 60s were much better.
I feel like she should be a something. Like, she should be a doctor at least.
Maybe.
Oh.
Anyway, so Professor Mumbletron reveals that he's been working on one of the spheres, the control spheres, from a Bond snowman that controls these Yetis, and he succeeded.
Yes, he did, but it disappeared or something? No, it started bleeping and whatever.
It disappeared, and now that's why he's freaking out. He's freaking out that the orb disappeared, and someone somewhere has come to, you know.
Do we not also in this introduction, really should be moving on, but do we not also in this scene have Sassy Anne look at the Yeti and go like, oh my goodness, like it's a Yeti, we should get out of here. And Professor Travers goes like, I've written down a quote actually, it's just a robot, it won't work without the control unit, nothing to worry about.
Well, again, why would you not know that, Sassy Anne?
That's my point.
Sassy Anne scientist.
They've both been working on these Yetis for ages.
40 years hence.
Well, he has been working on them for 40 years. Yeah. She's not 40 years old.
Well, yeah, but there's 40 years worth of data.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, point is, she should know better.
Right.
She's a shitty scientist. Miss Travers.
That's why she hasn't got
Miss
chair.
Miss Travers.
That's why she'll forever be an associate professor.
Okay, so anyway, one thing leads to another. The Nyeti suddenly just morphs into a Nyeti Mark II. Like, it upgrades.
Yes, how?
It's just a fade.
How does it do that?
There is no explanation.
It's very sort of 60s, 70s Japanese in that regard. I feel like old Godzilla films and shit would do something like that, like a wipe that doesn't necessarily
tally.
Show any process at all, but you know, we know it's a new type of Yeti.
Sure, but how was it upgraded?
Is it?
Well, the control signal reaches it and somehow it just morphs into a more modern Yeti.
Firmware upgrade.
And no, it's not. It's definitely a hardware upgrade.
Okay. The firmware upgrade triggers like it's
nanobots inside
yeah, exactly.
it to
yeah,
upgrade.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. No. So in The Abominable Snowman, the Great Intelligence got one of the monks to build these robot Yetis over centuries, I think.
Oh, Tibetan monks actually came up with nanotechnology somewhere in the 9th century.
I did read that somewhere, yeah.
Microwaves. Microwaves in nanobots.
Yeah.
Also Cornish pasties.
Mm.
Yep.
Traditionally Tibetan. But okay, so here's something that really pisses me off. Fuck it, let's just get into this right now. Here are my two major beefs with this. Number one, the Great Intelligence, even in this serial, cannot really manipulate anything himself. He can jump into someone else and manipulate that thing,
yeah.
Or he somehow, through like radio waves or whatever, controls the Yetis.
Yes.
The Yetis, in turn, splooge web on everything, because they even have like a little water pistol that shoots web,
yeah.
Right?
The silly string.
Yeah. A, how the fuck did this episode start? It starts with the TARDIS in space. Covered in Yeti splooge?
Yeah.
Well, was there a Yeti in space?
Well, no, is that... So, again, my interpretation was that the webbing...
Yeah.
...was the thing in which the intelligence...
Great intelligence resides inhabits.
Yeah, exactly, inhabits. So they're just
they
making more intelligence. Intelligence space. They like building him a conservatory.
But they... No. I like where you're going with this, but I don't agree. I mean, they splooge that stuff on soldiers to kill them, on explosives to, like, disarm them in a way.
Or is it they're just spraying it on there and then the Great Intelligence is doing that work?
Well, possibly, but it doesn't answer the question of how did the splooge get on the TARDIS in the first place?
Not sure.
Okay, fine. Agree to not even disagree. Agree to not talk about this anymore.
Absolutely.
Can I mention beef number two, though?
Go.
And then we really do need to speed up.
Hmm.
But beef number two is... The Yetis look like Yetis in order to, as in they were made to look like Yetis, in order to blend in. Is that your note?
My note is...
Nicolini is pointing at his phone.
My note is, why build robots not suited to this specific environment?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if they have that weird mighty morphing power Yeti function of like just, you know, snap your fingers and it now is a Mark II,
just
fucking turn it into something that, you know, looks London-esque.
Make it into a TFL worker.
Yeah, exactly. Make it look like a gigantic Transport for London worker, or, you know, a tube rat or something. Like, a Yeti is not going to blend in. And how did all the Yeti get to London? Did they walk there from... Did they, like, interrail from Tibet to London?
It's a hell of a network.
Wearing, like, a coat and a hat. Like, don't mind me.
Here's my network rail card. I don't know.
Anyway, this is my major beefs with this. Should we just carry on? Oh, Yeti kills Silver. Boom. Yeah. Let's carry on.
Oh, okay. One little thing. Again, I don't know really where we are in this first episode, but Jamie has a watch.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, I made a note of this. Actually, my note, it's much, much later on, I think. Oh, there it is. Is Nick, : Jamie has a wristwatch. Because we watched this serial together like a few days ago, 4 days ago, 5 days ago. And I wanted to give you credit for that observation, Nick.
Thanks. It just seemed really incongruous.
Yeah, why does he wear a watch? I guess the doctor gives it to him.
Oh, yeah, still, but like medieval Scotsman with a watch. It just seems incongruous.
Well, he's a medieval Scotsman who travels through space and time.
That's true.
I guess it's fine. Yeah.
I think that's probably just anachronistic. Okay, no,
he just forgot to take it off. Yeah.
Oh, so let's talk a little bit about the dystopia that they've inhabited.
Okay,
so I want to talk. So they've gone to Covent Gardens and they went up and they had a great comment about the Covent Garden stairs, which, again, for all our non-British listeners, the Covent Garden stairs are famous for being fucking terrible.
Hell. Absolute hell.
Just, I don't know why, but there's like 8 flights of stairs and everyone. It's really hard.
Even when you, at the bottom, if you are unfortunate enough not to be able to take the lift up, there's a sign that says like 842 steps to the top or something. Like, yeah, have fun.
So yeah, they made a cut and it was nice for me as a, you know, as a Briton, you know, in 2016 to hear that callback 50 years later and we haven't figured out how to make Covent Garden
exactly.
any better. Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so, but then they're up on the ground and they see that London is decimated and deserted.
Yeah, pretty much. Except the press still works.
Except there's a headline. There's like newspaper, you know, I forget what the headline was.
I can't remember. It was like...
Menace spreads or some shit like that.
Yeah, like end of the world now.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh no, here it is. I've got it here. Londoners flee as menace spreads. Ill-fated newspaper continues to operate. Why? Who put it up? Where are all the people? What is this infrastructure?
Does that not just bring us to the next plot point?
Campy Clark Kent.
Yes, exactly.
So, okay, we're down and there are...
You think it's Clark Kent? What's the name of the boy who helps Clark Kent?
Oh, Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen, that's what
I'm
thinking.
Well, but I call him Campy Clark Kent because he looks like Clark
he
Kent.
He does, yes.
But
English
yes, he's definitely more of a Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're with the soldiers that are in the tube and they're based at...
Goode Street. Yeah.
A few stops up from Covent Garden. And they've got a journalist with that's interviewing
exactly.
the captain...
The acting captain, because, and this is another piece of trivia, they're talking about the former captain leading this sort of, I guess, resistance in a way, the military presence there, Captain Pemberton, the fallen soldier, the guy who got killed in action. And Pemberton was the name of, I want to say, the script editor for The Abominable Snowman. It's like a little BBC in-joke of, hey, check it out, he's our fallen soldier, the guy who did the original.
That's nice, that's good.
But also this guy is, as in the, what's his face, Jimmy Olsen. He says that he's with English Television.
London Television, which I think actually at the time was an outlet.
He's with London Television. He's recording everyone on like a voice recorder.
Yes.
You pointed out while we were watching this, no, or Mirimu pointed out maybe while we were watching this, where's his camera?
Yeah, no, I think I got that now.
Yeah, and at some point he says, well, you have to talk to me because we have millions of readers who want to know the truth.
He says, I'm going to print all of this.
Like, make up your mind.
What are you? You got multiple press disorder? Like, what branch of the press are you with?
Exactly.
I mean, I fully believe that apparently it all exists still for all the people that have fled, but... Yeah,
so I reckon his colleagues in the office, they just said, what are we going to do, guys? Like, there's not enough space in the lifeboat. We got to sacrifice someone. And everyone's like, let's sacrifice Jimmy Olsen, shall we?
He doesn't even know what we do.
Yeah, just grab it, get him a microphone and tell him that he's now our new London correspondent.
He's just the temp.
Yeah, exactly.
Just the temp. Okay, well, so we've established that there are soldiers, they're leading some sort of resistance.
Yeah.
And they've also got their Danvers with them. They've been seconded into this mission.
Sorry, Danvers? What?
Travers,
the professor.
The
Travers. Yeah, exactly.
Why did I say Danvers?
Is it both of them, in fact?
Yeah, both of them turn up.
Professor and Miss Travers.
Yes.
And in the meantime, the gang, they go with the good old tried and trusted, let's split up and meet back here in 10 minutes trope.
Actually, I think, and I don't know if this is certain here, but it's just like, let's meet in exactly a few minutes.
Wait, is that a quote?
No, I don't think so. But it was basically, I was just like, come on, guys, be exact.
Yeah. And also, they split up with, like, the capable men to one side and a Victoria, who over and over again in the serial proves herself to be... No!
It's the other way around.
Damn it. It's later on when Victoria's on her own. Oh, yeah. Ignore me.
Okay, so what happens is that Jamie and Victoria go one way to look... Because there's a wire going somewhere.
Yeah,
Doc wants to follow it.
Like a power cable, I think.
Yeah, soldiers carrying. Cool.
And my next note, Nick, : Jamie has a wristwatch. Yeah. Here we go.
To be honest, there's not all that much to say about the rest of this episode. What we do get...
No, wait, there's tons of shit, man.
No, I don't think so.
There's tons of shit, man.
Okay, go, man.
Okay, fine. Do you want to do your final bullet point, and then I'll just bullet point everything that we absolutely have to mention?
Fine, okay. I was basically going to say the Jamie and Victoria get captured, and the Doc is off, and the soldiers blow up the tunnel.
No.
No?
No. No. Because the soldiers try to blow up the tunnel, and the Doctor finds the explosives, but then hides as two Yeti turn up and splooge on the explosives.
That's the beginning of episode two, as far as we're aware.
No. This is totally in part one. I haven't even got to my notes, my part two notes yet, and I've written explosives at Charing Cross, webbed by two Robo Yeti.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
And it's not even the last thing that happens.
Sure.
But yeah, okay, so whatever. So that's the first time that we get to see the web in action, as in the way that they disseminate their splooge. Anyway, handheld guns held by these robot Yetis.
Which, again, why?
I don't know, because, yeah, the Mark II, why couldn't it just come with a built-in splooge gun?
Don't know.
Yeah, I'll say one more thing before we jump into part two. One of the Yeti... Couldn't tell you which one, but one of the Yeti is played by John Levine. John Levine, who would later on return as Benton, who's like the right-hand man of the Brigadier.
Ah.
And somewhere, didn't I show you this when we were watching the film? I met John Levine at London Comic Con or Film and Comic Con or something a year ago or 2 years ago. And by the way, fantastic chap. John, if you're listening, please come on the show. So weird, this guy who played a very significant character, like a very important unit officer, he started his Doctor Who career as a Yeti. How awesome is that?
That is awesome.
I think that's pretty amazing. All right. Anyway, end of part one.
So, part two. Part two. They're interrogating Jamie and Victoria, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Who's this Doctor? Where is he?
Where is he? Why didn't you mention him before?
Yeah, all that sort of stuff.
And at some point, someone says something like, oh, come to think of it, we didn't hear an explosion.
It was like, well done, soldiers.
Yeah.
This comes up later, but they, and I've got a note that says, what type of sensors, like, notify you of fungal activity?
yes, exactly.
Because they've got this, like, light-up switchboard that tells them which parts of the tube are infected with this fungus. And I thought, have you got no sensors that detect, you know, giant fuck-off explosions? Or have you spent all of your budget on fungal sensors?
But also, do you have ear balls? Like, you've set off a massive explosion, and no one comments on the fact, like, no one notices that there's an explosion, and then later on, when they say, well, come to think of it, we didn't hear anything, they even said, like, we totally would have felt it. Like, we're close by. We blew up a huge section of the London Underground.
I just more questions. Why are you also underground?
I didn't think about this. Why isn't there a base of operations in, like, a building somewhere? Why is it also in the tube?
You know what?
I think it's that their actual headquarters are elsewhere, and they only have, like, maybe they're tracking the Yeti, and it seems as though the Yeti are based in the underground themselves, and that's why they've set up camping groups.
Oh, no, I get why they're down there. That's pretty much my assumption. But when you're setting off explosives underground, why be near it? Presumably, it could all come down.
Well, they're a few stops away, right? Which, I can't remember which stop it is that Doc finds the explosives.
Charing Cross?
Charing Cross.
Maybe.
And they're at Good Street? That's a significant ways away, man.
Yeah, but it's all underground, is it? So what? Can it all not all come down?
What? All the way from Charing Cross to Good Street?
I don't know.
Isn't it like there are two or three stops between Charing Cross and Good Street, I want to say?
Yeah, probably maybe four.
You think so? I'm going to go with three.
Definitely not looking at it.
Oh, yeah, let's not look that up. But either way, it's far enough away, I think, that they're okay.
Okay.
Anyway, we have the acting captain, Captain Knight, who hitherto keeps going, I don't want to talk to these youngsters, Jamie and Victoria. Just lock them up somewhere. Just put them in the rec room. And every single time someone says, well, maybe we should interrogate them, he's like, I don't have time to talk to these youngsters. We've got, you know, warring to do. And then all of a sudden, when someone goes, actually, I don't think that this blew up, he goes, quote, I think it's time we had a chat with those two youngsters.
I guess. I mean,
maybe I'm being petty.
Well, at one point, it's like, how did you get down there? Oh, you guys are just trespassing. It's like, if you're at this horrible state of, like, war and you've had to evacuate this one of the most major cities on the planet, they become more interesting to the kids. With all of those things that happen, all the terrible things, the kids are down there. They're not playing, clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
They just wander off for a stroll.
They could have just assumed that these were traumatized civilian survivors, right? Yeah. People that didn't make it to the evacuation or whatever.
Is there a pocket more? Are there? What's happening? Yeah. Why are you the only two?
Well, Nick, I'm pretty sure Captain Knight et al. Asked them, was there anyone else with you? And they said, no. And that was it. That was enough.
Done. Okay, great.
We've now established it was just two people.
Okay, fair enough.
Anyway, so we have a bunch of soldiers attacking some Yetis. These Yetis, I mean, the Abominable Snowman is a lost episode, so I've not actually seen the Yetis in action. I've reviewed them, I've heard them, but I've never seen them in action. And the way that they walk around here, I fucking love it.
It's fucking hilarious.
It's amazing.
They're like the Wombles of Wimbledon.
Yes.
Why do they waddle so much? Like, who designed this? For a very...
Oh, so good.
You know, for a confined space.
Yeah, and imagine how warm it must be in one of those. It's so good. But so we get a few soldiers just firing at them. Over and over and over, firing at them. Actually, maybe this is when they meet Jamie and Victoria. But, I mean, they must have been fighting these Yeti for quite some time.
Months. There are so many sort of sci-fi fantasy dystopia that are like this. Yeah. We've been fighting them for 10 years. Bang, 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 bang.
So why are you still shooting at them? Like, don't you realize it doesn't work?
just in case they need to read a magic number to this, like, five bullets didn't work, but six might. Well, six wasn't the trick. What about seven?
while that's happening, though, the journalist is listening in on like, over the radio, and he can hear gunfire, and he can hear people dying and screaming, and he says, quote, great stuff.
He's going for
all of my millions of listeners.
He's going for the Pulitzer, apparently.
All right.
The TV Pulitzer.
What happens next? Because my next note is, God, Victoria is so fucking dumb.
To be honest, I don't think lots happens of substance until Mumbletron and Victoria and Jamie meet.
Okay.
I think that's my next big thing.
We meet Evans. The lorry driver.
Oh.
Let's move to Evans.
Evans is great.
Talk to me about Evans,
man. So Evans is, from my mind, he sprung out of the television exactly like one of the characters from Dad's Army, which was another show of a similar time, you know, airing at a similar time, about the Home Guard during the Second World War. Basically,
very recently, there was a movie adaptation.
Yes. And the premise of that is a hopeless ragtag bunch of old age pensioners, incredibly young people that weren't fit for service in the Second World War, but were tasked with guarding the home front. And they were hilariously ill-equipped and you know, just awful. Awful militia. And that's exactly what Evans, like, you know, that character, just bumbly.
Except he's a young man.
Yes.
But he doesn't want to be
there. Doesn't talk like a young man.
No, he
doesn't.
Like an
old, grizzly Welsh miner.
I was just going to say country bumpkin, but yeah. I mean, he doesn't want to be there. He's a lorry driver. He was driving weapons or ammunition or something.
Yeah.
And they got attacked by Nyetis, but he survived somehow. He's the only person who survived as far as he's aware. Mm. Turns out he's not, right?
Yes.
The brigadier, soon to be brigadier, was with them as well. But he is absolutely hilarious. He's walking around on his own, singing in the tube tunnels.
Which, I mean, it's very well. They literally sing everywhere. For everything, yes. Singing is a Welsh pastime.
Sure. And I think at this point, it's him, it's Jamie, and a couple of soldiers, right? They're the ones that meet up. And Jamie goes, now I know why my note was Victoria's so fucking dumb. Because Victoria's been kidnapped again, hasn't she?
No, not yet. Because the way that she meets Professor Mumbletron and Anne is that, I mean, she's captured. They're already captured. They're captured, you know, they're captive.
Oh, by the soldiers. Exactly. Oh, I see.
And then they're introduced somehow to the professor, and I think it's Jamie and or Victoria notice.
It's Victoria. Victoria recognizes him.
Yeah.
Which is actually really nice, because she is, in this serial, across the board, I mean, she's an idiot.
Yes.
She is so dumb, but she's the only one that recognizes him, and then I guess Jamie recognizes him as well. I don't know. I'm not even sure the doctor recognizes him.
The doc hasn't met him yet.
Hasn't met him,
yeah.
No.
But yeah, yeah. Victoria recognizes him, and they have their reunion, which actually I really liked, because it's one of those great things, you know, as a fan of New Who, we love a recurring character.
Yeah.
James Corden in The Lodger and, you know, Riversong, those sort of characters that pop back, and we're all like, oh, yay, and there's more to this story, brilliant.
Yeah.
So that's nice, because, you know, one of the great advantages of moving temporally is that you get to pop back into someone's life, right?
Yeah, and meet them later on, and yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So I actually really like that. That was cool.
Agreed. And this is the first time that we get it. Before we jump into episode 3, did you notice that the doc wasn't in this one at all?
It did sort of halfway through. I was expecting to have like a major cutscene.
Yeah, it took me a while to realize it. I had read that in one of the episodes, while they were shooting one of the episodes, Troughton just went on holiday. And it was when we were approaching episode 2 that I went like, oh, right, this must be the one.
I love old tales of the BBC. Just like how Wild West it was. Like how absolutely new this medium was. And people hadn't figured out things like contracts properly.
Yeah,
it was just like, it's like, I'm out. Peace. East, I'm going Cornwall. Fuck you guys.
Or maybe it's actually, I mean, I reckon they must have told the writer, well, we need 6 episodes, but can you make sure that the doctor's not in one of them? Because Troughton's really hammering on about going on holiday.
All right, here's an interesting aside. What do you think the lead time at this point of writing to filming? Because nowadays, the season's written like a year in advance.
Yeah.
Then it goes through multiple edits.
Tons of pre-production.
Yeah, table reads, small Reddits.
Yeah, not just that. Like, they just have to build sets. They have to cast people. I mean, it's a much more rigorous procedure now than it was then.
Absolutely. But
I reckon there are weeks in between. I reckon there are weeks.
A couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think. That's exactly what I think.
So,
they're shooting 1 week and then they're releasing it the following. There's not time, because otherwise he was back from holiday the following week, right? Why not just shoot his scenes? They couldn't, because that episode has already aired.
I absolutely think that's exactly what's happened. Yeah. They just hadn't got hold of his schedule.
Maybe.
He's like, you know, I've had this caravan booked for ages.
I love that that's the kind of holiday you're imagining Patrick Troughton going on.
Absolutely the type of holiday. Let's go on Butlins.
All right, so episode 3, which is the missing episode. And so as I recall, your notes are fairly sparse on this one.
Jamie not stuck now. So Jamie and Evans were, at the end of episode 2, pinned down by this tunnel full of candy floss. And there was no escape, and then somehow there was.
Yes,
it's,
oh,
I
yeah.
don't know why.
You know what I think? I think that's the cliffhanger of this episode, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Of episode two, that's the cliffhanger. And then episode three, which is the stills, they become unstuck and then we don't know why.
Oh, right. I see. I see. Or possibly that's just another plot hole.
Also,
I've written that somewhere, but I think that's way later.
I've got a note for episode two that we may have missed, which just says, Cuddly Wuddly Floof Smoot.
Does ring a bell.
Which I think I was referring to the Yetis and how not at all menacing they are.
Yeah, they're just huge teddy bears.
Huge teddy bears, huge Totoros, tottering round, and I couldn't help but hug one. It just would overcome me.
Okay, well, let's jump into episode three, quote-unquote properly. I've got a little bit more written down, and maybe you'll remember what this stuff means. I didn't necessarily. Okay, let's start off with the Brigadier turning up. He's not the Brigadier, he's the Colonel.
The Colonel.
Colonel Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart, he turns up. Not the first time that Nicholas Courtney has been on Doctor Who.
When else was he?
He played a completely different character. He played a character named Brett Vian in the massive 12-episode, all of it missing, William Hartnell serial, The Daleks' Master Plan, which is fucking amazing.
Ladies and gentlemen, go back on Who Back When and listen to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a solo, so you're going to have to listen to me talk about 12 episodes. But it is such a good serial. I recommend the audiobook, actually. But Nicholas Courtney played a different character in that one. And here he turns up as Lethbridge Stewart. Lethbridge Stewart, we last saw him facing off with Missy, right? In a Capaldi episode. He wasn't on TV because I believe Courtney has already passed away now. But the character of Lethbridge Stewart had been turned into a Cyberman and, like, salutes to Capaldi and flies up into the sun and blows himself up. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
You remember, like, this is a Missy episode.
Yeah.
She's, like, made everyone into a Cyberman. All the dead people in graves come up and it turns out they're now Cybermen. A Cyberman as well.
Was that not Lethbridge Stewart's daughter?
Yeah, and her dad is one of the Cybermen. And he salutes to Capaldi. Anyway, whatever. Like, this is a character who has been... He's been in the shit. He has really been an important
canonical
and recurring, hugely vital character to this franchise. Oh, amazing. And this is the first time that he shows up.
He's badass as well.
He is. And very different from, like, all the other military dudes that we've met so far. Every single time that you and I have done a review, by the way, we end up talking about really stupid, naive military men.
I don't know why.
But, like, every single time we do, right? And it's not just him, actually. It's all the soldiers here. They're the exact opposite. They're actual professional soldiers.
Well, no, but see, the one thing...
Except for Evans.
Well, yes, but I think even with all of that, they're very soldier-like, because Lethbridge has something different about him. He's actually, at one point, I think that's further on, willing to entertain things like the idea of
time travel and
all that sort of stuff. He's like, you have a time travel box? Like, okay, all right, where is it then? Like, he's just on board, whereas Captain Knight is a prick about it.
Yes, that's true, and I think that's fantastic, but you would like him to doubt it just a little bit, right? Otherwise, he's just incredibly gullible.
I think it's the opposite. I think that he knows, through various things have happened so far on the freaking planet in this period of time, he just knows that there's more about it, He believes, which is actually the more prudent thing to do when you're faced by interstellar fucking Yetis.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
Well, so you reckon that I think that's a super good theory, but so you reckon that he believes the Yeti are alien in nature?
Yeah, I think so. Or at least I think that he's fine with that as a hypothesis because nothing else really fits. I think he thinks that, that's entirely plausible, which opens his character up for more exploration because, part of the military that can accommodate all of that.
There's another possibility as well, by the way. Mm. It doesn't happen in this one. It happens in the next... I just read this in the trivia. The next time that he shows up, I haven't seen the serial in question, but it's a serial called Invasion or The Invasion, and it's a Cyberman serial, and it's the first time that we get to meet UNIT.
Yes.
And very possibly, I mean, I'm sort of assuming... He may already be part of units, or maybe he is at least on units radar already now. We don't know this, and the BBC doesn't know this.
Well, he's forming units, yeah.
Yeah, also a possibility, right? So that means that this is his career. He works with alien shit and, protecting the Earth and so on and so forth.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Anyway, my next note is that they have a military briefing, and I've written, briefing looks like the Top Gun briefing meets General Akbar's presentation in Jedi.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, the stills at the very least.
Yeah.
I've written so little for this one, actually.
It's not easy, ladies and gentlemen, to be reviewing an episode that doesn't exist. I've got fungus around the circle line.
Yes, we've got that. And we find out that there is a traitor.
This is very important.
Yeah, this is hugely important.
So there's a traitor in their midst because the Yeti dolls,
I think, are missing. Isn't that how it works?
Yeah, and it calls them to stuff.
And
essentially, their movements are known by the enemy.
Yeah. Well, like the Yeti are drawn to those Yeti dolls.
The Yeti dolls, Yeti...
avatars.
Yeah.
Yeah, which we get to see in The Abominable Snowman as well. There's been sabotage as well. I've written sabotage to the main door and to the explosives room. That's what it was. It's not the Yeti dolls. That's later on. It's they want to set off another bomb. The doctor has this amazing plan of, let's put the explosives on like a wagon or something and roll it over to the Yetis. And if it hits a Yeti, it blows up. And otherwise we have a detonator. But then when they go to get the explosives, it's all like full of pulsating fungus gloop because someone puts possibly one of those dolls in there, or someone just cut open a lock and let the Yetis or gloop in there. I'm not sure. But yeah, anyway, so they have no explosives. Yeah, in fact, my note is, explosives room is full of alien gloop, and everyone's just like, okay, let's go back to the sausage fest. Yeah,
I think that's a fair summation.
And I think what I meant by that back then, on Wednesday, whenever it was that like they know that someone must have fucked with this, and they know that there are now... At the very least, they know that there is an alien presence in their goddamn explosives room.
Yeah.
But they just stick around in the same base. Like, they don't leave. They don't try to fight it. They don't, like, cement it or anything. They just go, yeah, fuck it, it's fine. Let's go back to the sausage fest.
Ugh. What else can you do, eh? And I think that's probably the most significant thing that actually happened.
I think so as well.
I think we can plow on through.
I think so as well. I think we end episode 3 thinking that the traitor is Jimmy Olsen.
Yes, because he's bolted, isn't he?
Exactly, he's left. Yeah. All right, so episode 4.
I start off with female hysterics from Cool Anne.
That's so crazy. I've got a hysterical female note somewhere in here as well.
Why?
That's crazy.
She's hysterical. Oh no, I know what we end up with.
Exactly.
Is that the Anne and Professor Mumbletron get knocked out.
Yeah, there's like a Yeti comes into their room.
Yeah.
Does it follow does it go after the dolls? Is that why?
It might well be, but either way.
It's straight up Steven Seagal's, both of them.
It does. And Anne comes to, in the beginning of episode 4,
yeah,
to reveal that Professor Mumbletron has been abducted.
Yeah.
And goes absolutely batshit crazy, which, you know, yeah, absolutely. You know, your father's been abducted.
I recall that you had a theory at this point when we were watching this.
What?
Your theory was like, why was she spared? I bet she's the traitor.
Actually, yes, that was. That is in one of my notes here. Why take him and, why take him and not kill Professor Mumbletron, and why not take Anne?
Yeah.
But well, my sort of thing there was like, why is she so hysterical? Because she's usually very cool.
Yeah.
I mean, earlier she had some great tete-a-tetes with Captain Knight and was very like, you know, very, very calm and collected. And she just loses her shit. So at this point, actually, so that's the... And, you know, spoiler to my review.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best things about this serial is the whodunit. Who's the traitor? The traitor in our midst.
Exactly. It's almost a little bit like... what's that science fiction movie called? I mean, it's later on. Sorry, this is a bit of a spoiler. But, like, when we finally get to the end of this, we realize how the whole treachery was performed. And it is a little bit reminiscent. And, in fact, all of these little interludes of paranoia. Is that person the traitor? Is that person the traitor? Can we trust those and those and those? It reminds me a little bit of... Is it Puppet Masters? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, yes.
You know those sci-fi films where you got some... There's an invasion, a film called Invasion as well, with Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman. It's all the same kind of shtick. So it's, I think, a fairly common sci-fi trope where you have an alien that like latches onto your back and it takes over. In fact, there's a Doctor Who episode with like a big beetle that latches onto your back.
Right? Oh, yeah, for Turn Left.
Oh, well done! Yes! Oh my god, JD is right now jumping up and down. That's his favourite episode.
Really?
I think so.
Okay, cool.
Is this? I think it is. JD, am I lying? I think it is. Yeah, anyway, okay. Hi JD.
Let's move on. So we get this description of the intelligence, the grey intelligence, which
With the Leopard 2? Fine. He showed up.
It's a formless, shapeless thing, like a cloud of mist. It's like, that's a form and a shape.
Yeah. It may not be, you know, geometrically easily described, but that's definitely not formless. it's not a hypothetical, abstract concept.
I know, mist is real. Ask Jamie.
Yeah,
it travels through time and space. But actually, intelligence is cool. Intelligence is wicked.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I need to bring back more great intelligence into Capaldi.
Yeah. Well, no, we haven't.
No, we haven't yet. We had Matt Smith.
It was Matt Smith, wasn't it?
And a bad version of it.
Not great. The snow globe that's led by Withnell.
Yeah.
Okay, so we thought that it was Jimmy Olsen who was the bad guy, right? And then you brought up, and I'm pretty sure that I agreed with you at that point, oh, it must be the daughter who's the bad guy, the traitor.
Yeah.
And we're about to think that it's Evans who's the traitor, because now Evans and the doctor, and possibly Jamie, I can't remember, they find the TARDIS. They go to the TARDIS because they reckon Jimmy Olsen's run there. Because Victoria, the fucking idiot, told him that there's the TARDIS.
Mm. Right.
And the TARDIS is completely covered in gloopy shit. Like, it's just in all this web buff, right?
Yeah.
And the doctor gets Evans to take a sample of this fungus, what's it? And pop it in
fungus
a little...
web.
Yeah. And pop it in a tobacco box. Right? Yep. So now we have a sample of web, which he wants to analyze, and which Evans has been tasked to carry for him, right? Then very shortly thereafter, we're back in the base, and the doctor opens the box, and it's empty, and we now realize Evans must still be carrying the gloopy web bath on his person, right?
Well, I think actually the point is that he got rid of it, done something, but...
But you think so?
Well, the thing was with that, it's like, that would be just the worst espion.
Yeah. So incredibly... He even, like, openly says, here's the box with the web, I want the box back when you're done.
Yeah.
Ugh. All right, well, or maybe that's just a plot hole.
But yes, no, I think at this point we do, or and they say maybe it's Evan.
Yeah.
My next note is hell yes, bazooka.
Yes. Okay, so we get that magnificent action set piece.
Led by...
Alistair Gordon, Lethbridge Stewart.
Brigadier badass.
Soon to be Brigadier.
Yeah.
Currently Colonel. God damn it, he deserves to be a Brigadier right away.
Colonel Kickass?
Colonel Kickass. I like it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It may possibly, as in, I mean, it's certainly, it's the least brainy, but it's definitely the most entertaining part of this entire series.
Absolutely. All underpinned by the score.
Which is the Cyberman music.
Is the Cyberman music. And again, sounds like the freaking Mysterons of Mr. Scott.
Boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. No, I can't do it.
This is the voice of the Mysterons.
Soundbite. Cyberman soundbite.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've already got that.
Yeah. Loads of jumping and bazookering.
And it's actually, vicious grenades.
Do they actually ever use the bazooka?
Yes, they do. Oh. And we hear it, like we hear an explosion, but we never see it.
Oh, one thing. So
I think.
We know that Yetis are impervious to bullets.
Yeah.
But not grenades.
Yeah, not explosions.
Yeah. So I would just retrofit my entire outfit with grenades.
Yeah, you'd think so, right? But they still carry on shooting at them.
Yes.
Quite a bit. The Yetis, they are... Weirdly, they're not taking prisoners this time. And it turns out the reason they're... and they're following Lethbridge Stewart quite specifically. And the reason they're doing so is because someone has popped one of the Yeti dolls in his pocket. And he just hasn't noticed.
Yes.
And we assume maybe that's Evans then.
Again.
Yeah. Pretty creepy. Either way, this action set piece takes... Like 5 to 10 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
It's a long scene.
There's a jumping boxes and people dying and...
Awesome shit.
Very cool.
Yeah. Kids were wetting themselves with fear. All right, so then we cut to the end of the story of the episodes, in which all of a sudden the Yetis now arrive in the base because, like, Lethbridge Stewart survives. He comes back to the base. The doctor goes, "Holy fuck! You clearly have one of those dolls in your pocket." And now they followed that doll to the base. They're now inside the base, and with them is who?
Professor Mumbletron.
Professor Mumbletron. That's a good name.
Professor Mumbletron is the intelligence.
Yo, he's speaking for us.
He's the intelligence conduit.
Exactly. I can't really remember if we got that in The Abominable Snowman, that we had the intelligence speaking through another human being. Maybe we did, actually.
I mean, one of my gripes, again, we'll get to this in the review, is that I'd like the intelligence to add more screen time across the six
episodes. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just this mysterious thing. Okay, so now we have a living human being.
Mm.
Who in... spoiler alert for later on. So we have a living human being who somehow, through what almost feels like something paranormal, is channeling the voice of the great intelligence.
Yeah, so the great intelligence must, I mean, it must be the same mechanism which the great intelligence can communicate with the Yetis.
But the Yetis are robots.
Yeah, but like some description.
So there's
of,
a, like a science-y version of telepathy. Like,
yeah, I mean, telepathy can be a science.
Sure, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So some kind of energy wave that in, or radio wave
signal,
or whatever.
Yeah. Some description of telepathy.
Okay. Yeah. So the great intelligence can control human beings.
Okay, I see where this is going.
Yeah. So if he can just do that, why do we even have a war here? I mean, why does he build Yetis? Why doesn't he just control everyone to do what he wants and then that's it?
If you're a formless, shapeless mist moving through both space and time,
yeah,
presumably inhabiting
you
all...
You get bored? Is that what you're going to say? if you want to do something else?
If you don't create giant... wibbly wobbly, like a giant wobbling, like furry Furballs. Monsters. You have no heart. He just wants a hug. That's it. The intelligence just wants a hug because he knows he can never have.
Oh, it's so sad.
That's why he's got killer teddy bears.
Well, either way, it doesn't make any sense to me. End of episode 5, episode 6. No, sorry, episode, wait, 4?
Episode
5, yeah. And the professor now tells us what the great intelligence wants, I think. Is that now?
Yeah, exactly. They do some questioning. And
He basically just wants to suck cut the dog's brain.
Which is one of those great gifts that keeps on giving. From now all the way up to Capaldi, you know, the motivation from so many malevolent monsters is to...
gain the Doctor's intelligence or mastery of space and time.
Or just the sheer act of consuming him.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's so much life energy. We've had that before, actually, I think, in Classic Who.
Yeah.
I think there's a Hartnell serial where someone just wants his life energy. Either way, you're absolutely right. And so this isn't the first, but it's certainly one of the first times that something along those lines happened.
Vicky kidnapped again?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So she's held hostage. I think this is hilarious, by the way. So the professor is now, he's under the influence of the great intelligence. The great intelligence says, hey, Doc, we want you to willingly sit down in this machine that I built and give me your intelligence.
Yes.
If you don't, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to take a hostage. I'm going to kill that hostage. The guy speaking is a hostage. They're in a room with two giant Yeti. Like, don't leave the room. Leave the Yeti where they are. Now tell him, if you don't do this, these two Yeti are just going to kill everyone.
Yes.
Including the hostage we already have.
Yes.
Oh, come on, man.
This is a better hostage. This is a more valuable hostage. It's Professor Bumbletron can bite
No,
him.
No, it's not a more valuable... Okay, well, we're going to get a hostage with boobs this time.
That's exactly it.
All right.
Wait, so there's more to that. So,
the slow motion dialogue.
No, the head colander.
That's later on. Let's put a pin in the hole. He can control a living human being for later on.
Yep.
Yeah. Pin.
I've just got the words cold-blooded.
That's Evans. that's definitely Evans. Because my next note is, Evans wants to give up the doc. Meanwhile, no one's asked him about the missing fungus sample.
Yeah.
He's in the room. Evans literally just going, well, let's save the girl. Actually, in fact, it's not just the girl. That's the thing. The professor says, the professor says, I'm going to take a hostage. I'm going to kill this hostage. But I'm not just going to kill this hostage. I'm going to kill everyone here. Yeah.
Why does Evans
get
any say in anything? He's already deserted them at one point.
Hasn't he deserted them twice now already?
He deserted the people that were fighting. He's just a deserter, which...
He's a serial deserter.
Which I got to think that as an army person, as a military person, is basically the worst type of thing you could possibly do.
Or hanging, right?
Yeah, as right.
He needs to be... Is it hanging? Maybe.
It used to be, yes.
Yeah, it used to be, definitely. All right, whatever. So, Vic and Prof, they're now hostages in Piccadilly Circus. And the professor...
Covering a lot of ground, aren't they?
Yeah. That's actually quite a long while. Piccadilly Circus, also, not on the circus, a circle line.
Not anywhere.
Wait, hang on. Line. They were on the Good Street. Good Street is
Gooch
northern
not
line.
On the circle line. That's northern.
No, Piccadilly.
Line. Central line. Good Street is central line.
Is this central and Piccadilly?
Yeah, it might be.
Might be central and Piccadilly. And now there are at Piccadilly Circus, which at least makes sense for Piccadilly line. I have no idea. Either way, they've covered a lot of ground. You're right. But the fun thing about the scene is that the professor snaps out of it.
Yeah.
Nicolelli is looking up a London tube map, ladies and gentlemen.
I can't help it.
Yeah, go for it. Which line is Gooch Street on? I want to say it's the Piccadilly line or the Northern line. Because I know that I lived on a tube line.
I thought it was this.
And would pass Gooch Street every single day going to work. Boom. Looked it up. Gooch Street is on the Northern line. Self 5.
Okay, fine.
Right, well, whatever. So the fun thing about this scene is that the professor snaps out of it, and he has no recollection of what has just happened. He even tells Victoria, like, don't look behind you. There's a Yeti there. And she's like, well, I know, you idiot. Like, you're the one who brought us here. Yeah, anyway, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. What really annoys me is I feel like we don't need Yetis, intelligence doesn't need Yetis. And it doesn't even need to take the professor out of there. Like, he doesn't even have to take a hostage. You can just go, well, I'll just go into someone else and just kill them.
Yep.
Right?
I'll inhabit everyone here.
Yeah.
Because I'm formless, shapeless, and exist in all space and time.
Exactly.
Also, you know when we found that the TARDIS was covered in splooge?
Yeah.
Wasn't it already covered in splooge when it tried to park in midair?
Holy shit, you're right. Oh, no. So, here's what I think happened. Okay. I reckon they're in space.
Sure.
Then the great intelligence that has no way of physically altering anything, has no physical influence on anyone, somehow physically splooges on the TARDIS. The TARDIS is now stuck in, like, whatever. And it's not the TARDIS that dematerializes and rematerializes it elsewhere. It's the great intelligence that takes it from there to, as in, like, controls the TARDIS.
But that's not my point. My point is that the splooge is still there.
No, I think it's just what's inside the splooge. Well, like, I see what you're saying, but I think it's just the TARDIS that arrives in the London Underground, and then later on, Yeti come by and they just...
Re-splooge.
Yeah, they jack off on it.
Right, okay, whatever, I don't care.
Okay,
let's get to the point where Doc turns back into his electrical engineer mode with Sassy Anne.
Exactly. My next note is great techno babble. In fact, shall we have a soundbite?
And the cross wires here.
I still don't see how you can...
Haven't finished yet. Now, if you detach the germanium crystal strip here, and then attach the collector and emitter...
Yes, and link up there, of course. And then the frequency variations, they'll automatically change.
Simple?
Yes.
Right, you get on with that.
Okay.
Now just check this sphere.
So, yeah, they do some stuff, and they have this painfully slow iterative process of, look, I can make this sphere move ever so slightly.
Just a tiny little bit, I can make it change direction.
Also, I'm going to whack it, and that'll make it go. And then that's cool. So they've sorted that. And
I think it is pretty cool. Is it not?
Mm.
Okay, well, either way, the idea being that this sphere, it's one of the control spheres that fits into the chest's whatever panel of a Yeti. And the idea being they're now going to capture a Yeti, pop that sphere into it, and that way they're going to be able to control the Yeti itself.
Mm.
And not just that, they also have another little gizmo that somehow just turns off Yetis.
Oh, I've got a thing.
Close range, though.
So that A looks like a Pong controller.
Okay.
Their weird little thing.
Yeah.
It looks exactly like a Pong controller. And then the second one was like, okay, so they spend an inordinate amount of time just making the sphere move slightly, right? Just slightly.
Yeah.
And then the doc goes, don't worry, I'll just reconfigure it to make sure it now does voice commands. Like,
that's a huge leap.
You're going to do what now?
You're going to teach this thing English?
And the thing, yeah.
And slang?
Well, actually, when we go through it and when Jamie does some of the controlling and other people do some controlling, it's not standardized phrases.
No, it's not like forward, stop,
just
left.
Like, yeah, cup your balls.
Yeah, at one point, doesn't the doctor call it Jimmy or something?
Yeah. He's like,
hey, Jerry.
No.
Jim?
Henry?
Henry?
I don't know.
It's like, oh, that's enough, Henry.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, cha-cha, real smooth. what the fuck type of commands are these?
Yeah, no, it makes absolutely no sense. Okay. There was another character whom we failed to mention before.
Hmm.
We're at the end of episode 5, and we haven't mentioned this pretty important guy. The staff sergeant.
Oh, wow. He's basically the most important character.
He's like the only soldier who's of importance except for the colonel.
Yeah, staff. Because
Where's he from, by the way? Is he English? Or is he straight
English.
Up English? Or does he not have an accent?
No, he has the famous staff sergeant accent, essentially.
Oh, right.
It's like a blustery, but it's English. It's his home county, he's English, but it's
he's Colonel Mustard, basically.
Yeah, essentially, there are pop culture is littered with that character, essentially, in that voice.
Sure.
Slightly, big brush moustache, possibly Colonel, or Staff Sergeant. Always a Staff Sergeant, actually, never really higher than that.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway,
so let's just very quickly summarise the career, the latter days of the career of Staff, aka the Staff Sergeant, things that we've missed out on. He's a total badass. At some point, when they found out, we have a TARDIS, the TARDIS is covered in gloopy gloppy splooge, they go, hey, Staff Sergeant, and Evans, and another soldier, go and fetch... Actually, it's Lethbridge Stewart. It's back in, like, episode 3 or something, when you were saying, oh, he buys the whole time travel idea immediately. His first command is, like, hey, Evans, Staff, and what's-your-face, dude who's expendable, red shirt, go and get the time machine. It looks like a police box.
Yeah.
And they go off, and they get covered in... Oh, that's my weird note. They get covered in the Yeti jizz, and we presume that the staff sergeant is dead. And that's one of the times when Evans deserts, I think.
Yeah, I mean, because actually hitherto everyone that did get splooshed died.
Exactly.
But it turns out Staff isn't dead.
Yeah, because now he turns up and he looks like he's like he's turned into one of those mole men. You know, like he now lives in the underground. Yeah. He's a total like subterranean hobo. But he's alive and well.
Yeah.
Seemingly anyway.
And he is he?
Because he's not. I mean, we find out later, right? But he looks completely fine and has like a cut on his head or something. On his forehead, and isn't he even... Evans shows up again, and Evans is then ordered to maybe put, like, a plaster on his forehead or whatever.
Yeah.
I think. Anyway, we end the episode. Should we do that? Let's end the episode with the fungus, quote-unquote fungus, breaking into the Good Street headquarters.
The Splooge Street.
Splooge Street. Except it now doesn't look like Splooge, and it doesn't look like that weird inflated... plastic bag oscillating in front of a flashlight that we get inside the weapons cabinet, for example. Instead, it now just looks like smoke.
Well, no, it sort of looks like...
Or is it liquidy?
Yeah, it looks more liquidy. It looks like a not very well-set meringue.
I think there's both.
Yeah.
I think we...
It's a Heston Blumenthal-like BBC production.
Well, I think there are occasions when we see the fungus in smoke form, and in other cases we see it's sort of meringue-like, and I guess this is the meringue I just misremembered.
It's web, it's meringue, it's smoke, it's silly string.
Yeah, it's everything.
It's everything.
Oh, something we didn't mention. The end credits of each episode, rather than just white text scrolling over black background, it scrolls over... yet another fungal texture, which is, it looks like microbes under a microscope.
Yeah. That was cool.
Very cool. Very creepy. And in fact, over the Doctor Who music, we also get the gross, wet fungus noise of...
Which, if you listen to all of Who Back When, you'll hear a lot.
Yeah, quite a bit. Causes a lot of grief in post-production as well. Anyway, and that's it. Shall we just end the episode?
Yes, let's.
Yeah. Episode 5 over. Episode 6. Final episode. My first note is, Miss and Doc pretend not to have the Yeti under control.
Why? Well, no, not why. I get that, subterfuge. But they...
I don't.
But it's not even that they pretend not to have it under control. They don't know which one they do have under
control.
Exactly.
They're not
they
markings
just, they just like, let it go. It's like, don't worry, we'll just make it do stuff. And then I'll know. Just like, you know, we'll just make it do the Men in Black dance. And then we'll know it's the old one.
Yeah.
Just slide with me. Just slide with me. Just slide with me.
That's such a good song, though. It totally holds up, man. That and the Wild Wild West song. Those are like my favorites. I'm kidding. Obviously, they're shit and hideous. All right. Yeah, exactly. So what they do is, maybe this happened in episode 5, but what they did was they used their remote control to turn off one of the Yetis long enough to replace the sphere. Hmm. And now they actually have a remote control Yeti, which is voice activated.
Yep.
Anyway, and now they don't want to make it official. They even tell the Lethbridge Steward, oh...
Before we stop,
oh, go for it,
before
go for
we go
it.
On, I just thought, if you've got a control box, and now a Yeti, just go see the other Yetis, get close enough with the other Yeti to stop them and just take out all this.
Yeah, exactly. Disable everyone. But they don't, because that doesn't make any sense to them.
In a way.
In a way, this is the best idea. They even tell Lethbridge Steward and everyone else, no, we failed to gain control of the Yeti.
That I don't know. Oh, because they think they're still a...
Well, they say there's a traitor, and the only person who will know that we have control over a Yeti is the traitor. Because clearly the traitor will know that he can't control the Yeti, right?
Right.
And that way, when someone says that they know that we've succeeded, we know that that person is the traitor. That is, I should you not, that is their plan.
That is their plan, which is endlessly convoluted, and I can't imagine children in the 60s really followed what the fuck was going on.
But also, like, why would the traitor reveal himself like that? Okay, it doesn't matter. The good guys are not captured by the Yeti, including the good Yeti.
Yep.
And there's even a bit where Evans gets picked up by Yetis, and he's literally picked up. Like, yeah. Just
oh, yes.
Scooped Which, up by these...
I remember thinking at the time, whilst, okay, yeah, Yetis could do that, but whoever is playing these Yetis... built like a fucking brick shit house.
Yeah. Something tells me that was not John Levine in one of those two Yeti suits. I mean, maybe we have another case of, you know, the Cybermen, the huge Cybermen guys, or the Ice Warrior. They were huge.
Yeah.
Can't remember what's his face, who played one of the Ice Warriors, who was...
in everything.
Exactly. Indiana Jones et al. Yeah, you're right. Huge.
Yada, yada, yada.
Go for it. I've lost my notes.
I don't know. The Doc gets captured, right?
He doesn't get captured. He gives himself
up. He gives himself up.
Yeah.
With the idea that, okay, we're all defeated now. The intelligence can have my brain.
Yeah, exactly.
And he gets like a colander smashed potato hat.
Yeah, to put on. And he uses his little remote control gizmo to turn off the Yetis who are about to put the heads colander thingy on him.
Yep.
Somehow sabotages the headgear.
I gotta tell you, in all of these instances that he sabotaged something or changes something, knew who would have just sonic that.
Yeah, the next serial, this is a massive tangent, but it's the first time that we get to see the sonic screwdriver.
Ah, because they were too lazy.
Well, it hadn't been invented until the next episode.
So the Doc's plan, since we're privy to, but no, none of the other cast, is to somehow rejig the colander hat.
Well, he does.
And infiltrate great intelligence, which is what we're supposed to infer.
Yes.
And then what happened?
Well, he steps into this glass, this miniature Louvre pyramid. Right?
Well, the pyramid, isn't that what controls the, or at least does in the Vulnerable Snowman?
Yes, but it's a very different kind of pyramid. So the pyramid seems to be, I guess, the standard shape of the technology used by the great intelligence.
Yes.
But the pyramid that appeared in The Abominable Snowman was a pyramid made of spheres. Okay, so the Doctor gets into it. At this point, he's given the voice command activator to Jamie. And Jamie simply, he can't handle it anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, hang on. No, before he does that, we also get to see who the traitor is. This may be how it's presented. At the very least, at some point, we get to hear the great intelligence speak to the Doctor. And he does so through a speaker on the wall.
Yes.
There's like an intercom on the wall.
Was super creepy. I remember.
But also, how can he do that? Why does he do that? Why not just talk through anyone? Because he did talk through the professor before, right?
Well, now, see, he, again, spoiling for my reviews, but I would rather that great intelligence rather than the one that can inhabit all things and then control automatons.
Yeah.
I would rather creepy, like, can speak through, you know, speakers and do that sort of, which I think is what they will do with the great intelligence in the future.
Yeah, it's more tech-based.
Yes. But yeah, that bothered me. I was like, what? How come you've just inherited this power now? We're 6 episodes in, man.
Yeah, well, it seems to me like, I'm not sure if I agree with you, because it seems to me like that's much easier to do than just talk through someone's mouth.
Well, no, quite, exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's like, I'd rather that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Sorry. I agree with you. But since we already have established that he can speak through people, he wouldn't even have an intercom on the wall. I have a question for you, by the way. Who's built this headquarters for him? Who's built this lab?
Yeti.
They're not really dead. Extras enough to do this.
I don't know, man.
Pretty sure they're not, man.
Well, more problems here.
Okay.
Does he ever need to speak ever? Can't he just beam his thoughts into everyone's brain?
I would think so, yes.
I mean, that would be a really shitty show.
Yeah.
It'd be a really terrible doctor.
At some point, the show will just end, and if anyone asks why, it'll be because the great intelligence won.
Yeah.
So I finally just thought about it. But yeah, okay, so he announces that, oh, I'm going to reveal the traitor to you now. Over the intercom.
Yeah.
And then in waltzes the traitor, who is...
Star.
Yeah. Whose name is Arnold, by the way.
Arnold. Yeah, which, again, at the end, they're like, it's Arnold.
Like, who's Arnold?
And
we
have to look at each other like, which one's Arnold? Oh, it's Star. Star Sarge.
Yeah.
They could have ramped that up a bit better.
Yeah. And, okay, also, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, no, go for it.
I was going to say, the least inspired of the selection of saboteurs amongst that could have been was the least captivating for me.
What stuff?
Yeah. As the, for what it meant for the story, stuff was you know, great and enjoyable.
Wait, no. I think, well, either I'm misremembering this or you're missing something.
Okay.
Didn't Staff die when he was in the splooge.
Yes.
And this is now his dead body been walking around, and everyone thinks that thought that he was alive, but he was in fact dead.
Yeah.
And under the control. That's not like a banal thing. That
it's not too banal. No, it is. I do, you know, the cadaver walking around and doing that sort of
that's
thing.
That's amazing.
That's
isn't
kind
it?
Of freaky. No, it's freaky, absolutely. But I think it would have been way cooler to have dumbass Evans be the great intelligence.
Yeah.
And then it what it tells us then is that the intelligence has the capability of
masking himself, like of playing the chameleon.
Exactly.
And the intelligence
so freaky because then he could be anyone at any time. Any character that we encounter from that point to this in Who could be the great intelligence, which opens up a fucking, you know.
Okay, yeah, that's true. But okay, here's my theory. I think Evans was controlled by the intelligence at some point. I don't think that Evans just like threw away that fungus gloopy splooge. I think the intelligence got him to do so.
No, that's the thing. That what I'm saying is that it'd be cooler if he was the great intelligence, not controlled by.
Oh, I see. Was the intelligence. Yeah, but we, even in New Who, we get to see how the intelligence is. He can't inhabit people. He's energy. He can manipulate people, but he can't inhabit. He doesn't inhabit. He inhabits with Nell.
He's inhabiting Staff, isn't he? Because Staff is now dead.
Ah. No. Well, is he? Yes, he is dead, but is he inhabiting him? Because this was going to be my question to you, and this is the reason I said before, like, we even get the scene where Evans puts a plaster on his forehead, because when Staff shows up now, he's wearing, like, a metal head thingy, which seems to be what's controlling his lifeless body enabling his lifeless body to walk around. But before he was getting a fucking blaster on his forehead, and he wasn't wearing a metal crown.
Can we go with the coolest option here? The coolest option that he doesn't need the metal crown, and actually
he's just using it. It's weakened at Arnie's. Using Arnie's body.
That is the coolest version.
Yes. Yeah. Agrees.
Let's roll with that.
Fine. Let's go with that. But I'm pretty sure. I mean, I might see if I can grab an episode 6 screenshot just to see if he's wearing something on his head. Well, regardless, Jamie now panics because the doc's about to get his brain sucked cut and tells the good Yeti, kill everyone! Save the day, which you're able to.
Smashes the pyramid.
Smashes pyramids, kills Arnie again. Kills all of the other Yeti, right? Yep. Or is it that they die when he smashes the pyramid, maybe?
Smashes the pyramid, all the Yeti die.
Okay.
And the great intelligent, like...
Exactly, and we basically end the episode on the Doctor being quite disappointed.
Admonishing Jamie.
Yeah. He's like, no, you don't understand. I had when I fixed the colander thing, it was so that I would suck the great intelligence's intelligence out, and he would be no more. But now he is somewhere in space and time and might return. Because very clearly at this point, he was already a return foe. He was bound to return again.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I thought that was cool. Because I always think stuff like that. I just think, well, while everyone's waiting for this, why doesn't someone just smash that?
Yeah.
And he did, and I was pretty impressed with that.
Yeah. End of...
Serial.
Yeah. Web of Fear. Reviews.
You really go cool. first.
Thank you very much. I feel really bad for what I said before. Do you want to go first?
I'll go first. No, you go first.
Okay. All right. So the best thing about this is not necessarily the return of the Great Intelligence or the return of the Yetis for me, because it makes no sense that we have Yetis in London. And the Great Intelligence, we don't get to see enough of it in this one. What is the best thing and the deciding factor for me rating this up is Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart. He is a fantastic character, and he's exactly... I remember him from, like, Doctor Who in colour, right? When I was a kid. And this iteration, this very first iteration of him, is exactly as I recall him. Like, quite stern, very professional, very like, oh, I'm on the Doctor's side, yada yada yada. And it's really nice to see him like that from the very, very beginning. Victoria's shit. Jamie's pretty cool. He's pretty badass. Loved Evans as comic relief. I loved the paranoia element of who's the traitor. Is he the traitor? Is she the traitor? And we ended up being wrong every single time, by the way. We had how many theories? I don't even know. 4 or 5 while we watched this. We were always wrong. The Doctor is really good, even though he's missing from an entire episode. I enjoy him, and I loved the technology behind it. I like the idea that we're now going to tweak the spheres so that we can tweak a larger machinery so that in turn can then manipulate an even larger machinery. But here's the thing. The Yetis are actually inconsequential because he manipulated the headgear. In fact, everything is inconsequential because he was able to manipulate the headgear. All he needed was the remote control that Miss Travers had already fixed she had already invented it, right? Nick is nodding his head. She only needed to get that remote control from her and then simply tweak that headgear, and then everyone would have won. We wouldn't have needed to lose any lives. We wouldn't have needed anything. Either way, great serial, good pace, good action sequence. Oh, Jesus Christ, that action sequence is fantastic. Good acting and so on and so forth. Okay, I'm giving this a 3.8.
Okay.
Only rating it down for all the plot holes.
Fair enough. As always, I agree with a lot of the things that Ponkin says, except for...
Okay.
Pace. I don't agree this is well-paced. Oh,
okay.
I think over six serials. I think that there's probably two and a half episodes worth of good material here.
Actually, saying that, we both agreed on that when we watched it. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, I think the pace was you know, they stretched a lot of stuff for no good reason, running around the tube stations without real lot of purpose or a lot of action or a lot of meaning. Leth Pursuit was awesome. Action scene there was awesome with the bazooka and everything. Evans was awesome. Funny as hell and, you know, good Dad's Army impression. Ancillary characters were very much that. You know, actually, I don't think Victoria had nothing to do other than be lost and be a sexy 60s vic. Jamie had some good stuff. You know, whilst he didn't, his character wasn't especially progressed in any way, he had some good things to do. Motive was, again, kind of there. You know, I was
actually, really there?
Well, you know, I bought it, but not over the six episodes. It was sort of, it revealed itself towards the end. Yetis are inconsequential. Those are big plot holes there. Like, it basically, how does the intelligence works is the big plot hole. What he can do and what he can't do, or that the being can or cannot. And, you know, the sort of like, yeah, the hey presto, I can absorb this thing with a couple of tweaks to this, you know, helmet, even though it took me 4 hours to move this ball slightly to the left. And also I can teach it English. Bothered me. But yeah, the sort of the intrigue, the whodunit was kind of cool. And the cadaver is, you know, reanimated.
It's so
cadaver.
Cool.
That's cool. Yeah, that is cool. Yeah. Having said that, I think there are more interesting permutations of someone else being the traitor. And it being the... I think Evans would have been a way cooler idea. So with all that being said, I'm going to give it a very strong 2.5.
2.5?
It's a strong. It's middle. It's middle for me.
Oh,
it's,
wow.
Well, I'm coming off the back of what was one of the best serials ever.
Which one was that?
That's The Enemy of the World. That was really fucking good. So I'm going 2.5. I think that's fine. I could watch it again, but I also couldn't. Like, it's also fine for me to not see them, but I, you know, I wouldn't be upset.
Well, I have the DVD now. I'm definitely watching it again. Okie dokie. Nice one. 2.5. Holy shit. We have some listener minis as well.
Yes, we do.
Let's jump into those. Listener minis. Okie dokie. So we have three listener minis / maxis, reading them in chronological order. First one comes from Trenton Bless. Hey, Trenton. How you doing, man? Waiting for a response. Trenton has sent an incredibly long maxi review. I mean, it's classic Trenton style. And as always, it includes a fact file with some pretty spiffing trivia. As it's such a massive maxi review, we're just going to truncate it. We're just going to read a couple of excerpts. Nick, do you want to pick one?
Let's. The Web of Fear is a tour de force for Douglas Camfield. He's mastery at creeping terror. Victoria lost alone in the tunnels. Shock reveals, lurking yetis, the fungus, and the spectacular battle in Covent Garden. He also polishes moody dialogue scenes. The Doctor explaining the intelligence and secrets of the TARDIS to the Colonel, possessed Travers revealing the intelligent plan, and the row at Silverstein's Museum.
Kablamo. I'm going to do his in conclusion. He says, so overall, what do I think of this serial? Well, it's better than its predecessor, that's for sure. This was the serial that cemented the yeti as icons, like the Ice Warriors, the Cybermen, and the Daleks in my eyes. I mean, the serial had iconic villains, so iconic they were pulled up for new series revivals. Well, the intelligence was, anyway. Indeed, it would be nearly 45 years before the great intelligence returned. Oh, really? And when he did, he came back in a big way, tying up loose ends and overall being a greater villain. So I'm giving the serial a 4 out of 5. The serial has its problems, but they are so few and far between that they aren't really worth mentioning, are they? The sets were fantastic, the monsters were classic, and Troughton and the rest of the cast were at their best. The serial is maybe the best of season 5 of Classic Who so far, but we still have two to go before we're done. Just as a little PS, he wants Podcast Land to be reminded of the fact that he changed his rating of Enemy of the World. The mini review, or rather maxi review of his that we quoted in that episode, in that he gave it a 2.95, he would like to change that to a 4.0, meaning he likes Enemy of the World and this one just as much.
Oh, that's controversial.
It is a little bit, isn't it? Anyway, Trenton Bless, thank you so much for sending in your enormous maxi review. Fantastic as always. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to follow Trenton on Twitter, he is at Trenton Bless. That is Bless with two S's.
All right. So the next one is from Peter Z.
Zunich.
How you doing, Pete?
Hey, man.
So Pete says, Hey, I've finally caught up to the podcast with my viewing. I've been in the past for so long, it's good to finally be here. This is a solid and enjoyable story from the beginning to end. The pace is constant throughout. I was never less than interested, but it was never enthralled either. It's a shame the great intelligence won't return for so long. Or does it? There's no bad performance here, and the portrayals are quite successful in keeping you guessing about who the collaborator is, even for those of us that have watched the series before and forgot.
The foggy web ooze is a great extension of what we see at the end of The Abominable Snowman, and it's great to see Professor Travers years later. This is something Doctor Who as a whole didn't do enough of. Agree. I completely agree with you, dude. He goes on, it's a good reminder that people's stories continue after their adventure is over. I could almost wish for a novel of his adventures between the two stories. I think that's just you, Pete.
Even though Victoria is just going along for the ride as usual, I feel she stands out in this story with constant portrayal, smooth dialogue, and a range of emotion. I could wish they found more for her to do, though. It seems the writers are stumped by her character's limitations, though. She's a good actress and a good character, but needs more to do than be a damsel. True?
Yeah, agreed. He goes on, Colonel Lethbridge Stewart, we've been waiting for you. This man is in control of the scene from the minute he steps into it and won't stop stealing the scene or supporting it with perfection until the painting on the wall in Peter Capaldi's era. His first command on screen here doesn't go entirely well, though, does it? Remember the initial shock he portrays when he returns from his team being wiped out entirely? I believe this event is an influence on many of his decisions later on. He's not going to ever let that happen again. His reliability and level-headed thinking, along with the Doctor getting them out of a truly hopeless situation here, is what ultimately leads to a total and undying trust in each other for decades to come. As such, the most missed footage of the week award goes to the introduction of the Brigadier, Colonel.
The London Underground set is flawless. Don't take my word for it. Listen to the commentary found on the recons and DVDs. Posthumous rewrite of the week would to be replace some of the random I'm going out here for no good reason scenes with some more character moments with Victoria and the other characters. One thing she's good at is getting other characters to open up, and there should be more of that in this story.
Nice one.
Overall, a good solid romp, but I never feel it's an amazingly edge of the seat adventure. 3.9. Which is,
that's more generous than even I gave it.
Yeah, I think that's slightly odd, Peter said, with your last comment there. You've only got 1.1 left of a review.
Yeah, but he does bring up so many positive points here.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with the Victoria
difficult
point.
Yeah, oh, agreed. And Stuart. Actually, all of it. Maybe with the exception of wanting to know even more about Professor Travers. But yeah, okay. I get your point.
Well done, Pete.
Yeah. Peter, thank you so much for sending that in. Next one comes from Stephen.
How you doing, Steve?
Hey, man. How you doing? All good? All well? Glad to hear it. Stephen says, the Web of Fear introduces the man who will be Brigadier, and was he ever a breath of fresh air? After the belligerent or obstructive military leaders of serials past, seeing Lethbridge Stewart's ally with the Doctor, providing aid and a reasonable amount of scepticism instead of stubborn disbelief was welcome. Yes, we discussed this. We talked about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
150% agree with you, Stephen.
On the cons, the serial has an issue that tends to get me in old Who serials. It consists of a lot of running back and forth from point A to point B, then back to point A, with one final trip to point B for a good measure. Honestly, I'm not sure that it actually has it any more or less than past serials, but it felt more here. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I didn't know what stop we were at, what part of the underground.
Yeah. Yeah, I agreed. For pros, Stephen says, I like the special effects shorthand of using the underground map to track the progress of the web fungus, even if it does bend the rule of show, don't tell. The setting of the London Underground also gave things a confined feel, which adds to a sense of suspense.
Favourite scene has to be the firefight with the Yeti in episode 4. It helps it was accompanied by the Cyberman theme we've heard before, which is a long-standing favourite of mine.
Bingo. Right? Yeah.
This
nice
is
one.
The voice of the Mysteron.
One detail that stood out for me is that the Doctor actually fails to destroy the villain. Yes, nice point. Usually he'll manage to destroy any threat the Monster of the Week may pose. The Daleks alone have been genocided about 6 times now. And along with that comes the irony that with all the concern over who was a mole for the intelligence, it happened because of the one person the Doctor could trust implicitly.
Nice. I originally had my rating pegged at about 3.5 or 3.6 because I'd forgotten the firefight, but that brought it up for me enough to declare my final resting at 3.9.
Nice,
which is
review.
The same as Peter
yeah.
said.
3.9 seems to be that's what people
point,
had.
One, yeah, 0.1 less than Trenton. And what was yours again?
It was 3.8. Pretty sure.
Okay, so I'm an outlier.
Yeah. Yeah. Stephen, thank you so much for sending in your review. Ladies and gentlemen of Podcast Land, I'm pretty sure you already follow Stephen on Twitter, but if you don't, you should go and high-five him. He is at sgamer82. That is 82, the number. Thanks again, Stephen.
Next one comes from Chris.
Hey, Chris.
How you doing, Chris?
What up?
Chris says, I want to start by saying that I like this episode back when all we had were episode one and telesnaps of the rest. I've been looking forward to this rewatch since I discovered your podcast around Galaxy 4. Which has become a lot more entertaining after listening to you talk about it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris.
That's very kind of you.
This is the first time I've watched the episodes 2, 4, 5, and 6 since they were found in 2013. Spoiler, it's even better now. I have one more thing I'd like to get out of the way at the top of this mini, which is slowly becoming a maxi. I have to give a shout out to the awesome Nicholas Courtney, who appears on screen with every Doctor in the classic series at least once, if you count Dimensions in Time. I've taken the liberty of shortening Colonel Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart to Kaggles.
What? No, it's Kaggles.
Kaggles.
It's Kaggles. It's the best nickname. It's totally my new favourite nickname.
I am pronouncing Kaggles. There you go. Kaggles.
It's Kaggles.
Kaggles.
Miramu is we're recording this in front of a temporary live studio audience, and Miramu is looking at us like, what? No, that's hilarious. That is actually hilarious. Chris, well done.
What are we going to do when he's Brigadier?
Bagels. Then he's Bagels.
Okay.
All right, shall I continue?
Please.
All right, Chris goes on. Now to the serial. I liked that we start in the middle of the action and that the weird circles on the TARDIS wall were of use as grips for Jamie and not just decorations. Yeah, okay. I'm wondering if you guys picked up on the Doctor spooning Victoria. Yes, we did. The character of Travers is a little less self-centered and conniving as an old man. I also think Travers feels like an early version of the plot that will be associated with a third Doctor. He gets pulled into working for the military as a scientific advisor. That's an interesting thought. I hadn't considered that.
Mm.
Hmm. I like that Victoria is the one who recognizes Travers, considering that she is his real-life daughter. I made this point in The Abominable Snowman, but yeah, definitely. It's the actual father of what's-her-face who plays Victoria. Sorry, I interrupted you there. Interrupted me there. Chris goes on, the actor playing the reporter does seem more involved and in the way than he did in the reconstruction episodes that I had seen previously, so much so that him popping up doesn't seem like it is out of nowhere. I really like Kaggles when he shows up and is equally suspicious of all characters and things except for the Doctor and the TARDIS. His rapport with Jamie makes me glad that we get one more serial with the two of them. It makes me sad that episode 3 is still missing, so we don't get Kaggles' first on-screen appearance. Once Kaggles... You're going to say something there?
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, that makes me sad too, actually.
Yeah, definitely. Once Kaggles comes into the serial, he steals the show. His war on the Yeti in episode 4 was truly the best part of the found serials. The camera work, acting, and special effects scream of unit at its best. The only thing missing are Benton and Yates. I rewatched episode 4 3 times and loved every minute of it. This contrasts heavily with the conversation-heavy episode 5. It wasn't a bad episode, just not as exciting in contrast. I thought that the end resolve and the actual plan associated with the Great Intelligence was far better than in The Abominable Snowman. Yes, I completely agree with you, and just a fun note, in a way, Benton is in this episode, because Benton is also played by John Levine, who is here in the shape of a Yeti.
Overall, I would have given the recon that I'd previously watched around 3.0, but the serial is so much better than the visuals, I give it 4.7, with my only major mark off being for my annoyance with one plot hole. How was the TARDIS trapped in the web in episode 1?
Yes!
The Yeti... You shush. You let Chris speak. The Yeti are the ones sparing the net from the weapons and not the Great Intelligence.
Yes,
how
exactly.
Did the Yeti get...
Stop!
How did the Yeti get into the space to trap the TARDIS?
Chris, yes, absolutely! Oh my god, that's exactly what we said! I completely agree with you. Why am I squeaky?
I don't know. P.S. The big difference from a recon to a mostly full serial gives me hope that maybe Galaxy 4 wasn't as bad as we thought.
Well...
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. It'll still be too super sexist about high-maintenance chicks versus... Log monsters, and beauty is everything. Awesome mini review, Chris. Thank you so much for sending that in. That's a very generous rating.
Very.
4.7.
Huge.
Okie dokie. I think that might be it for this week. What are the next reviews that we have coming up?
New is Human Nature.
Goddamn right it is.
Classic is
Fury from the Deep.
And I know what audio he is.
Oh, God. What is it?
The Escape Goat.
The Scapegoat.
The Escape Goat.
The... Oh, I'd like to escape that goat. yeah, well, let's see if we ever review that one. Nick, can people follow you on Twitter?
They can.
Here's a soundbite of us quite poorly singing your handle until we think of something better.
N-I-K-U-L-E-L-E.
Still prefer the rap. The rap is awesome.
The rap is great, yeah. You can follow me as well. I am at Ponk, and here's a soundbite of JD singing how you spell that.
P-O-N-K-E-N, Ponkin.
Thanks, JD. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. Catch us next week. Until then, be rad next to each other. Rock on and ciao.
Bye.
Kablamo. Did you enjoy the show? Then please do what the cosmos compels you to and spread the gospel of who back when. Tell your friends. Don't have any friends? No problemo. Tell some strangers. Like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/whobackwhen, all in one word. Are you on Google Plus? Then find us on Google Plus. That's plus who back when. And when you do, tell us why you're on Google Plus. Who Back When just got its very own Twitter account, no lie, so give us a follow. You guessed it, that's at Who Back When, all in one word. Check us out on SoundCloud, vote us up on Reddit, listen to us on Stitcher, and head on over to our website, whobackwhen.com, where you can leave a comment, submit a review of your own, and peruse our visual index of aliens, monsters, and more, which increases in kablamos with every episode. And lastly, give us a rating and review on iTunes. Not only would it make us super chuffed, and it really, really would, but as thanks, we will transmigrate your iTunes nom de plume into the credit list of trailers for fake Doctor Who audiobooks produced by Who Back When. Have a poke around our bonus episodes to make more sense of that. That's it. Rock on and be rad and excellent to each other. Catch your ear balls in our next Classic Who Review, New Who Review, or, still funny, Audio Who Review. Ciao.
Who Back When?